Mount Mercy University, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, presented Father Nyakor Pierre Giorgio Austriaco of the Order of Preachers at the Aquinas Lecture Series on March 25, 2024. Father Austriaco is a professor of biological sciences and professor of sacred theology at the University of Santo Tomas in the Philippines. A large problem of today's Catholic students falling from faith when in college and even before is the inability to answer the question of the relationship of God with science. The purpose of the lecture was to reunite theology and science. Father Austriaco is a Dominican priest with PhDs in biological science from MIT and doctorate of philosophy as well as doctorate in divinity from the Angelicum, the Dominican University in Rome. Using a philosophical approach to the existence of God, drawing on St. Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle, he draws on the dog, or God spelled backwards, as a class of objects to show what God is not. When one uses the thinking of St. Thomas, it is called Thomistic. To that end, we have drawn upon fellow Dominicans, the Hillbilly Thomists, with their song, I'm a Dog. Dogs have a special place with the Dominicans since their founder, St. Dominic, was fond of dogs and is sometimes pictured in artwork with his dog. This is in spite of the theological opinion of St. Thomas that there are no dogs in heaven. Stay with this special program through which Father Austriaco brings science back together with God as it was in the beginning.
The depths of this desiccation, the height of these scraping towers, the width of this waste in a sea, potential for action. Inside hold a treasure, take a hold of this earthen vessel. Worn and weary, but still potential for action. I'm a dog with a torch in my mouth for my Lord, making noise while I got time, spreading fire while I got earth. How you wish it was already lit. Give me your fire, I'll do your work. I'm just a dog. Sounding through streets and over mountains, put out your torch and spread some fire all around you. I'm a dog with a torch in my mouth for my Lord, making noise while I got time, spreading fire while I got earth. How you wish it was already lit. Give me your fire, I'll do your work. I'm just a dog for my Lord. When I found him,
my heart, Lord,
took hold of me.
I let
got love, spreading fire while I got earth. And how you wish it was already licking me a fire. I'll do your work. I'm just a dog for my Lord.
President Olson, for that kind introduction, and for Professor Brian Cross for the for everything, for the invitation, as well for being a wonderful host all day today to meet many of you, and both at meals and just a conversation. So I'm basically a geek for God. That's what Dominicans do. We study, we think, in order to help our brothers and sisters navigate some of the challenging intellectual obstacles to faith that we can encounter in the day-to-day life. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is about God. A lot of people, when I go to science conferences, and I go not dressed with my habit, because if I did, they'd think either I'm a Jedi or they think I'm a KKK. So it's either one. It's happened before, you know. They think this is a whip. So what happens, I go in my Roman collar, and often when I go to a science conference, what happens is the scientist will say, "Oh, Father, I studied Drosophila. When you put a banana out, that's where a fly comes." And then you're like, "Wait, where's the loading control for that Western?" You know science, and you start talking, and they'll say, "Well, where'd you get trained?" And I'll say, "MIT." And they're like, "What happened to you?" You know, I will say, I encountered the Lord. I encountered the Lord at MIT on the 7th of May in 1996. Changed everything. So what I would like to do today is to talk about God and to provide in many ways an account of God that I have found incredibly convincing, not only for explaining who God is, what God is, but why God, having God as part of your worldview, is so important for being a scientist. Because I'm going to propose to you that God makes science intelligible. Science is possible only in a world where God is creator. And if you remove God, and it's not that many scientists have actively removed God. I think many scientists simply don't consider God as part of what we do or part of what we study. So they simply abstract God and marginalize him. What I would like to suggest to you is that if you step back and look at science, the enterprise of science that I love so much, you will see that in order to live a coherent life, an intelligible life where science makes sense, you need to have a God, and not just a God, but a creator God understood in the Judeo-Christian sense to explain why this is all possible. But before we begin, I'd like to start with a prayer. This is the prayer that I begin all my classes with. This is the prayer before study, a shortened version of it, written by my Dominican brother, St. Thomas Aquinas. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. O God, creator of all things, true source of light and wisdom, graciously let a ray of your light penetrate the darkness of my understanding. Give me a keen intellect, a retentive memory, and the ability to grasp things correctly and fundamentally. Give me the talent of being exact in my explanations, and the ability to express myself with thoroughness and charm. Point out the beginning, direct the progress, and perfect my work. We ask you this through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. I remember encountering this for the first time when I entered the order, And it was striking to me that for Aquinas, a teacher had to speak with charm. Isn't that amazing? That when you are a professor and you get up there to teach, you're expected to speak charmingly, however you may understand that today. So my lecture today is going to be divided into three parts. First of all, we're going to talk about what is God. You notice, I'm not speaking about who God is. We're talking about what God is. It is said that Thomas Aquinas, when he was 10 years old, asked the abbot of the monastery, "What is God?" And he so confused the abbot, because that question was so uniquely put, that the abbot got flummoxed. And in many ways, Thomas spends the rest of his life interrogating that question. What is God? Not who is God, but what is God? And then we're going to talk about whether or not that God exists. So what is it? Does it exist? And then I'm going to try to demonstrate how this account of God explains science. It makes science intelligible. So we're going to begin with what is God. Now you notice we're talking about definition. So we're going to have to start, as Aristotle would have it, with things that are more familiar, and then move from more familiar things to less familiar things. So God is one of the most mysterious things, if not the most mysterious things we will ever encounter in life. So we're going to talk with something that's more familiar. Dog. What is a dog? We're going to just talk about how we think about defining things. So if you notice, if I start off with this definition, a dog is an animal with four legs, what would you say? Is it true? It is true, but it's not specific enough. It's not determined enough. And so what we do is we're going to say a dog is an animal that barks. Now, I am just going to say that we're going to assume right now that barking is what distinguishes dogs from non-dogs. I have students who say, "Father, my dog does not bark." And I'm just going to say, your dog is weird, because for the most part, dogs bark. I'm just going to take that for granted. We're not going to argue out whether or not dogs bark. Now, you will see that this is an Aristotelian definition. So Aristotle, thousands of years ago, would say that if you want to define something, you have a generic class, a large class, and then you figure out what makes this thing part of a subset of that class. So animal, dog is an animal, but what's unique about this animal, it's an animal that barks. So you see, this is how we define, how we specify things. Now, if this is the case, you notice we had to identify that one characteristic that distinguishes dogs from non-dogs. That's how we worked, and we said it was barking. And that's controversial, of course, but we're going to take for now that it is what distinguishes dogs from non-dogs. Now, the way we do it is we look at dogs and we compare them to non-dogs. That's how we go. Let's look at all the dogs. They're barking. The non-dogs, they moo, they meow, they do all sorts of things, but they don't bark. And so once we do this comparison, we can get down to the definition of dog. Now, if we follow this approach, then to define God, we would have to identify that characteristic that distinguishes him from non-gods. Do you see the logic? Dog, non-dog. So if you want to talk about God, you've got to find some characteristic that distinguishes God from all the other things that are not God. Now, you cannot look at God. You can't do this because God is not like a dog. So what we can do, and this is called the negative way, the via negativa, is that you can look at non-gods and then move from there to God. So what we're going to do is we're not going to look at God. We're going to look at everything that's not God. And we're going to try to identify something that all the non-gods with the little g have in common. And if they have that in common as non-gods, then the big G God is not that. You see how we're going to do it? We're going to go backwards. So what we do is we call non-gods creatures. And so we ask, what is the defining characteristic of creatures? Just like if I said, okay, what's the defining characteristic of non-dogs? That's what we're doing here. Now what happens is if you can put if you want to rephrase that question, you can say, what is held in common by electrons, tables, dogs, angels, and galaxies? I had to put angels here because we are post-Newtonian. So if I don't put angels, my students will say mass or matter, because that's how we think in the 21st century. So I've got to put angels in there. This is not suggesting that angels exist or don't exist. They do, by the way. And they're here. There's a lot more than us here, because you brought your at least one. And Father and I said we have two each, right? So because a priest gets a second one when he's ordained, not to protect him, but to protect his priesthood for the sake of the others to which he's called to serve. That blew me away when I found that out. It's like, oh my God, I get another angel. That means there's two people watching me all the time, not just one. Angels and then galaxies. So we're going to look at electrons, tables, dogs, angels, and galaxies. Now, if you try to figure this out, and my students have tried, they get flummoxed. So we're going to go to Aquinas. Now, Aquinas is going to say this is not physics. So physics is classically understood as the study of things that move, movable things. He will say this is metaphysics. This is the subject that moves beyond physics. Now, it only turns out this way because metaphysics, in the writings of Aristotle, the book on metaphysics came after the book on physics. But it is now, metaphysics is used as a term, not the way that the Barnes and Noble if you go to the Barnes and Noble metaphysics section, it's all about wizards and chance and the occult. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the study of reality, the study of being. So that's what will come into play when we're talking about angels, galaxies, etc. And what Aquinas will say, this is what he says distinguishes creatures from non-creatures, is that in all creatures, what they are can be distinguished from that they are. You're going to go, what? Okay. So translate this, their essence can be distinguished from their existence. I'm going to have to explain it. I'm going to have to uncover the depth of what he said by talking about essences. So an essence is, what is a thing? So you go, what is a unicorn? There it is, right? And you will say, the essence of a unicorn is that it is a horse with a single horn. Now notice the Aristotelian definition. It's a horse, bigger class, and I specify within that class some specific difference, some characteristic that places it in its own group within the class of horse, single horn. Now, if I say, what is a Harry Potter, right? And there he is. He's a lot older now. He's a lot older now. I saw a picture of him the other day. It's like, oh my God, that's Harry Potter grown up. The essence of a Harry Potter is that he's a boy magician, class, imagined by J.K. Rowling, specific difference. Now, one of the things you should see here is that you can understand what I mean by a unicorn, a Harry Potter, or a pencil, even if they do not really exist, right? Sorry, Harry Potter does not really exist. But you understand who Harry Potter is. You understand what a unicorn is, and it's not part of your thinking to determine whether or not either of those exists. You can understand it independent of the existence question. So we can understand their essences without knowing if they exist or not. And the reason for this, from a Thomistic perspective, is their essence is different from their existence. The reason why I can talk about what they are without considering if they are is because what they are has nothing to do with whether they exist or not. Those are two separate questions. You can distinguish them. So if you wanted a math equation, right, creatures are defined as beings where their essence is not equal to their existence. Does that make sense? That we're trying to logically deduce what Aquinas proposed. Now, if this is the case, if creatures are beings whose essence can be separated from their existence, then you just negate that. God is that being whose essence cannot be separated from his existence. Because you see, every creature, you can separate the two. So with God, who's not a creature, you cannot. So it's a basic negation. And so what ends up happening, God is that being whose essence is existence, right? And more profoundly, Aquinas will propose that his essence is existing. Now, what does this mean? It means this. His essence is existence or existing. And so what I would like you to see is I want you to compare the two. A dog is that animal that barks. God is that being whose essence is his existence. You see how logically it follows. You're able to distinguish a general class, in God's case being a being, and what's unique about God is his essence is his existence. Now, this is from St. Thomas's Summa, the third question of the first part, Article 3. God is the act of existing. Now, I want you to contemplate that. God is existing. And I want you to see how Aquinas will notice that when we did what we just did, we did not refer to the Bible at all. This is philosophy. We just deduced from talking about dogs and looking at things around us, we deduced that God is existing. Then he said, go look at sacred scripture. If you look at Exodus 3, and of course this is the famous burning bush, when Moses asks God, what is your name? What does God say? Yahweh. And if you translate that as I am who am, I am ising. I am existing. So Aquinas will point out, isn't that amazing? That philosophical reasoning, which leads us to conclude that God is existing, corresponds very nicely to Revelation, where God reveals himself as the act of existence. I am who am. And if you remember from the great gospel this past weekend, Jesus, when he speaks about who he is in front of his persecutors, will say, I am. And he uses the sacred name of God. This is why everyone should get so shocked. Because he goes back and he quotes, I am. Jesus is actually referring to this and he's saying, I am existing. I am here. I have been around before Abraham. If you remember that, the conversation was about, you're not even 50. And he goes, before Abraham was, I am. And so he refers back to this. So I want you to see, for Aquinas, God is a verb. And you have never encountered a verb before. You've encountered nouns that are verbic. You sitting, me standing, me talking. But Aquinas proposed that God is fundamentally a verb. Now, when my students hear this, they're like, huh? Exactly. God is a verb. And because God is a verb, he will always remain beyond our ability to grasp completely. Because you and I know things based on our experience. We have experienced nouns. We have never experienced a naked verb. And that is what God is, as Aquinas has argued to both philosophically and theologically. God is a verb. Now you notice, you will struggle, because if I actually ask, can you imagine the act of running without a runner? Can you imagine a verb by itself? You can. So imagine someone running along the Cedar River, and then all of a sudden you remove the runner. What do you have left? Nothing. So you can imagine, for Aquinas, You can never imagine the act of existing without an existing thing. God is beyond our imagination. He can be conceived. You can think of God. You can talk about him. But you can never imagine him, a picture of him. Now, we will attempt to do that. And of course, the great, incredible privilege of knowing Jesus is that Jesus is the face of God. Jesus is he who gives us the object to whom we can relate, because the act of existence is so mysterious. So God is always beyond our imagining and understanding. And I have to stress this to my students, because my students will say, "I get God." I said, whatever God you get cannot be the God who is, because the very nature of God is that he's beyond getting. And even saying that God is love, right? So I always say, properly speaking, God is not just love. God is loving. The act of loving is God. He is actively loving all the time. It's not love as a thing. It is a verb, loving. But notice, we haven't discussed whether or not this God exists. And that's why we have to move to that question in the second part of this evening's lecture. Does this God, this verb, actually exist? And in order for me to do that, I need to ask you this question. Did your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather exist? How many of you believe that your great-to-the-seventh grandfather existed? Raise your hand. Okay, hopefully everyone does, right? Now you go, absolutely. And the reason being, you are the definitive proof that he existed. Now, what's striking is that we would say, in a classical Thomistic way, your great-to-the-seventh grandfather's existence explains your existence. Without him existing, you couldn't be. Now, you are an effect of your great-to-the-seventh grandfather's causality. Now, your great-to-the-seventh grandmother's causality is in there too, right? But, and in fact, there are many, many grandfathers and grandmothers to whom you owe your being here and their causality. But I'm just pointing to this one particular individual. And you can see it this way. There is a great-to-the-seventh grandfather who had fun one night in 1780. And because he had fun one night in 1780 with your great-to-the-seventh grandmother, hopefully they were married, there's a causality, and now you are here. You see? So this is a classical way to talk about how causality can explain existence. So now if you ask this is the principle of sufficient reason by Leibniz. Every effect must have a reason or cause. This is like his principle. It's called the principle of sufficient reason. If something is there, you need to there must be something else that explains it. So, causes explain effects. And this is actually, scientists take this for granted. I go hunting for genes. I'm a gene hunter. Because I believe that if I see something, there must be a gene that explains why this cell or this organism is behaving this way. You see, and you go, why is that? Well, there has to be. This is the principle of sufficient reason. Okay. And you can infer a cause from its effects. So if we ask the question, does God exist? I'm going to say, absolutely. And here, this is interesting. Remember, creatures are beings whose essence is distinct from their existence. That was part one of this lecture. And that you can distinguish them. This means that they could exist or they could not exist. So non-existing creature is an essence without an existence. We call this like unicorns and Harry Potter's. You, on the other hand, you are an existing creature, so you have an essence, human being, with your current existence. So if I ask the question, you notice creaturely existence is not necessary. So, and we call this contingency. Creatures are contingent beings. So this is the question. If creatures could not exist, then why are they existing now? So why are you existing now? Owen's over there, and I had dinner with Owen, and I heard all about your education program, and he's telling me about teaching mathematics in middle school. So if we ask, why is Owen, how do we explain Owen's existence? Now, if I asked you, why is Owen awake? Okay? You're going to say, well, Owen is a cause for his own being awake or being asleep. And hopefully, I don't get too boring and he doesn't fall asleep. But he's awake because he keeps himself awake. Do you understand? And the way we do this, like, Owen, go to sleep. And Owen can just pass out, and we can wake him up. Owen, wake up. And you can see we can do that. So Owen explains his being awake. But if I ask Owen, why are you here? Now, I'm not talking about why are you here now versus otherwise. I'm like, why do you exist? He cannot say, because I am making myself exist. Because otherwise I'd say, okay, Owen, stop doing that. Now, if Owen stopped doing that, and he was in fact responsible for his own existence, it's not like he would die. So a lot of people, they get confused between existing and life. The opposite of existing is not existing, otherwise known as annihilation. He would just go, boom, there, he's not there anymore. And then I'd say, okay, Owen, come back. Boom, he comes back. Now, Owen can't do that. In fact, none of us can do that. Okay? And so the question now is, if he can't explain his existing, what does explain his existing? Because remember, everything has to have an explanation. So we go, why doesn't Owen just cease to exist right now? And we ask more philosophically, we go, what is the cause of his existence? How do we explain that? And what I hope I've shown you is that we do not explain our own existing. We can explain our own being awake, but not our own existing. And so therefore you have to say, if you cannot explain your existing, you must attribute your existing to something else. And you must have received your existing from another who can give you existence. And this other we call God. So you see, God is an explanation for why you exist. So you will see God's existence explains the existence of everything else that is not God. And because remember, God is the act of existing. So the analogy here is like the Easter candle. So you go, you know, the Easter candle for the exultant, and we're approaching the Triduum this week. It starts off, there's a single candle with a single flame, and then that flame from that single candle is used to light the other flames. And so the other flames receive their flame, the other candles receive their flame from the one flame. In many ways, you receive your existence from the one who is existing. He is thinking you into existence. Now, I remember teaching this once in class at PC, and someone said, oh my God, Father, I just realized I am God's imaginary friend. Now, there's this new animation called If that's coming out, Imaginary Friend. Now, an imaginary friend is someone you think of. Now, you don't have the ability to make that imaginary friend a real friend. You do not have the capacity to make that IF an RF. But God does. So when God thought of you, he thought of you once as a pure idea. And then when he created you, he thought of you by giving you existence. And I have students who are like, I think God's forgotten me. And I used to say, well, look at a mirror. Now I just say, take your iPhone now. Look at the selfie. There you are. If you are there, God still remembers you. Because if he's forgotten you, you will disappear. God is keeping you in existence in the way that J.K. Rowling kept Harry Potter in existence when she was thinking about him. This is before she wrote anything down. When she fell asleep, when she stopped thinking about it, he ceased to exist. She, as the author, thought him into existence. God is the author of life. He thinks us into existence. So what happens is he is the only being whose essence is existence. We talked about that earlier. So he explains contingent beings. He explains us. And he makes us exist. So you see, when we talk about creation, we are not talking just about what happened 13.8 billion years ago during the Big Bang. When people think about that, when they think about creation, they think about, oh, he created. He's creating now. You exist now because he's thinking about you. So we're talking about the greats to the seven grandfathers' existence explains your existence now. God also explains your existence now. It's one is horizontal, one is vertical. So one is a creaturely causality from 1780 is the cause of your essence. You are a human being because your great to the seventh grandfather was a human being as well. If your great to the seventh grandfather was a doggy do, you would not be a human being. You'd be a doggy do too. But there's also divine causality coming on, the cause of existence, 2024. And actually, this is the truest view of this, is God explains all of history because he explains everything that exists. So what happens now is that in the same way that your great to the seventh grandfather explains your existence, God explains your existence as well. Now, where are objections? So their objections are, if God did not exist, then why do contingent creatures exist? That's the consider. And some people, I've had this at MIT, they just do. They don't need a God. But here's the thing. This is unreasonable. We have never seen an effect without a cause. You're violating Leibniz's principles of sufficient reason just because you don't want to think about God. So you say he's not there. But you need God to explain your existence. Now, the other one is, I've also heard this, someday, some scientific law will one day explain why we exist. The question then is, why do those scientific laws exist? You just go back one step. You see, because existence by its very nature is about the fundamental structure of reality. And so you go, God explains scientific laws as well. They exist. Anything that exists, God has to be there to explain why they exist. So you see, his existence explains the existence of everything else that is not God. This is a classic, classic Catholic philosophical argumentation. Now, we call this the first cause. Okay? He's the first cause that explains the existence of all the other causes and effects. Now, what's interesting is that now we go down to science. It's what I do. My second love. How does God explain science? You see, there are two rival theories. So whenever we work in science, we have rival hypotheses, rival theories, and we ask for which one of them has more explanatory power. Which one of them explains more stuff? That's the one we go with. So if you look, there are two rival theories, theism and atheism. There is no God, there is no God. We're not going to deal with polytheism now because if you went into that, you discover that polytheism is eventually reduced to theism because you can't have many gods if God is defined in the way that Aquinas defined it. So which one explains science better? That's how we do science. Which hypothesis explains the data better? So you will see that science is the systematic investigation of a physical world that is ordered and mathematically describable. Math is cool, right, Owen? Okay? And so you'll see what happens is that if you ask the question, why is there a physical world that exists? So the first question is, why is there a world? Theism, God. We've talked about that. Atheism, it just does. And I have students that it just does. The world just exists. And I go, effect without a cause. Eh. Okay? If you go, why is there a physical world that is ordered and mathematical? So it's not just that the physical world exists, but the world is actually ordered, and math can describe that order is something that we need to ask an explanation for. Theism, it's not just a God, it's a personal God. Because a person is the cause of order. You know this, you walk into your freshman year, you know, you share a room. You know when you walk in, the bed is made. There are curtains on the windows. There are books lined up. Oh, my roommate, whom I've not yet met, has moved in. You don't just say, oh, there was a doggy here. We assume that the order of the room indicates reason. It indicates intellect and choice. And so in the same way, when we think about the mathematically describable world, it's not just a God, it's a personal God. And again, for atheism, my friends will go, it just is. Now they'll say, science will explain it one day. I go, yeah, but what explains science? You see, it just keeps going back. Effect without a cause. So in my view, the God hypothesis has more explanatory power. It outcompetes its rivals. You see, it makes sense of why science is even possible and why you can do science the way we do science today. Now, what's interesting is that science explains why my faith in God is reasonable. And this is how Aquinas would have it, faith and reason. It's not that one goes first. It's striking. I was having a conversation earlier today with someone who was like, faith always goes first. From the Catholic perspective, there are two sides of the same thing, the same coin. The two lungs by which you breathe, right? So it's not that you breathe with one lung first or the other one. You have to have both lungs to breathe. Faith and reason work together. So now, but this is Dawkins. If God created everything, then who created God? I've had this so many times. It's like, ding! There's the killer. You're done. I'm like, no. Because here's the way it works. Can a triangle have four sides? You go, of course not. By definition, a triangle cannot have four sides. Nothing can make a triangle with four sides. By definition, God cannot be made. Why is that? Because his essence is existing. You see, we start just like you have a definition of a triangle, you have a definition of God. No one made God in the same way that no one can make a triangle with four sides. Both involve logical impossibilities. Like I've had my students say, well, can God lift a rock that is impossible to lift? I go, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's self-contradictory, you see? So, and God is reasonable, so God doesn't do, we can't talk about logical impossibilities. So if someone asks you, why does God exist? We say, existing is what God does. It is also what he is. That's what God is. It's what he's doing. If someone asks you, why does a triangle have three sides? And I've had little kids ask me that. Why does a triangle have three sides? Having a three sides is what a triangle does. That's what it does. And that's what defines a triangle, you see? So you have to now look at the explanatory power of the two hypotheses, God or no God. And so it is reasonable to propose that God is uncreated because it explains creation, which makes science possible. You see, it's an entire argument where many parts come together to support each other. So he has much explanatory power. He explains why the universe exists, why it's intelligible, and why it is meaningful. So it's striking that in a secular society, we struggle with meaning. Because you see, in a secular society, if there is no God who gives us meaning, then it is you who gives your life meaning, which may be great until your life sucks. Because what's so striking there is that all of a sudden my student says, I have failed in life because making my life meaningful was the task of my life. So when my life is not meaningful, I must have failed. And I've helped thousands of people to die as a priest, and I spent many months as a hospital chaplain at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and New York Cornell Presbyterian. And what you see, usually I go into a room, there's a Catholic, and I'm talking to the Catholic, and as I leave, the other one goes, excuse me, and then the curtain goes back, and there's another patient. And the patient, can I talk? I'm not a Catholic, but can I talk to you too? And we have wonderful conversations about life and death and about meaning. And I'm just going to point this out. What are the two questions that every single human being asks at the end of life? Father, you don't get to answer that because your experience. What do we ask at the end of life? What do you think? Yes.
There's something after.
So there's one. So where am I going? What's after? What's the first one they ask? Nope. Not really.
Did I do my job?
Sorry?
Did I do my job?
Something like that. It's like, was my life meaningful? How do I evaluate my life? Do you understand? At the end of your life, you ask, did I do it right? They never ask me about the cars, the houses. They always ask. And the answer, I talked to a very wise priest, and he said, give them St. John of the Cross's answer. And he said, St. John of the Cross, in the twilight of your life, you will be judged by how you loved. And I will tell that dying patient, because of your life, did someone know love? And then they will, yes. And I say, because of that, your life was meaningful. So you see, it doesn't matter what else you've done. And so it's striking how God provides an overarching framework in which we can ask other questions as we confront what it means to be human. Now, I have to end, especially this week, I have to end this way, right? However, God is not an explanation. He just cannot be an explanation because he is persons. Now, you notice he's not a person. He's persons. And I think it's so important this week, especially to end with this, right? He is love. This week, especially. Thank you very much. So Q&A.
I will just facilitate on the microphone. We can just speak up.
Get up and project.
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm going to use the loud voice. Okay, so... in my head, science can't prove God's existence. Can science, disprove God's existence? If we needed to prove God's existence through science, is that even possible?
So I think the argument that I'm making here is that, so properly speaking, science, especially science as we understand it today, interrogates forces and matter and how those interact. God does not exist within that realm of specification. So, we don't say, I'm going to study music. Music is going to help me to understand cells. But you'll say, cells are not the subject of music. Music is the mathematical patterns of sound. So, properly speaking, the object of science does not include a transcendent being whose essence cannot be distinguished from his existence. So it's properly metaphysics, it's philosophy. And then, of course, you have revelation. Right? So, if you ask, is Professor Cross there? Whether he exists or not, you can look at that. But you would never know his name unless he spoke to you. Which is why philosophy can only go so far. It can tell you whether or not this person is there or that person is there. But that's not the coolest thing about people. The coolest thing about people is what they love, what they hate, what the stuff that they owe. You can only know from either talking to them or talking to their friends. This is why the church is so important in Christian life, because our knowledge of God is not just from our knowledge of God, who he is. He hangs out with a whole bunch of people. And you have to hang out with his buddies to figure out who he is. It's kind of like a friend-friend thing. And the Lord wants to be your BFF. And in order for you to do that, you have to be incorporated into his community of friends. We call that the church. Yes?
When thinking about God and his existence, how do we make sense of his existence before he created space-time?
Yeah, so we would say, so God, so first remember, God is an eternal, so God, there is no beginning or end of God, there's no beginning or end of time. With God, God is eternal. So God is three persons enjoying their company. So when we rise from the dead, so I remember my professor in theology saying, the purpose of life is to enjoy the life of the triune God. You are going to hang out and dance with the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And that eternal dance is more that will fulfill every desire of your heart. We do not say that God created because he needed us. Okay? God in himself is complete. But we will say, well, why did God create? That's really the question. The reason why he created is he wanted to share his love. The nature of love is to want to diffuse itself, to want to give itself away. So God, from before he created, was God, and he had everything, and he's enjoying it, and then he's like, you know what? Let's go ahead and make others with whom we can share the love Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, if you go to the Eastern churches, the Eastern church will say, the Father loved his Son so much, he created human nature to give it to him. It's a beautiful perspective to understand that creation was a gift from the Father to his Son. So, but we do not ever want to say that creation was necessary to complete God, to perfect God, to make God happy. He didn't need us, we need him. Other questions? Yes?
So, in the Old Testament, the burning of the bush was the first, like, God saying, this is where I really am, mm-hmm. after the garden.
Mm-hmm.
So, did no one just know who he was until then?
No, it's not that I don't think that no one knew who he was. It's just like, you know, ooh, there's that cute freshman walking around campus. Everyone knows him, but no one knows who he is. So in a sense, you know the guy, but you don't know him yet. So we believe that God reveals himself to his chosen people to prepare. So why did he reveal himself to the chosen people? To prepare for the gift of his Son. Right? Because he wanted his Son to be part of that people. Remember, Jesus is a Jew. That makes us Jewish as well by adoption. Hope that explains it. Other questions?
So how is simplicity related to Aquinas?
Simplicity? So if you talk about divine simplicity, because God is an act of existing, God is radically simple. Simple means absence of parts. There is no top of the act of existing, or bottom of the act of existing, or left or right. So the act of existing is radically simple because it has no parts, and so God is radically simple with no parts. Yes?
So I've always heard the expression that, like, math is the language of the universe. Would you think that that's applicable to religion? Like, could we say that, like, you talked about God having personhood and order, could you then by extension say that, like, oh, math is...
It's striking because the question would, I would put it this way, does math explain you? Can math explain you? It can explain you to a point. I would rather say that music is the language of the universe. Because music is emotional math. And so you can be explained by math. We do that all the time. If you go to the doctors, they're going to quantify you, and they're going to put numbers to you. But that's not all of you. There are parts of you that, in a sense, transcend that. That's why I prefer music or poetry, where you're describing order, but there's an aspect, an affective aspect to it, that math cannot completely capture.
So So would you say those are like concepts like poetry or math, are those human expressions?
That's a wonderful question. I think the way I would put it is that once persons become part of the universe, there's an added dimension to math. Because free will, so if we are radically free in the way that we believe we are, at least if you're not a determinist, then there's an aspect of your behavior that cannot be predicted by math. Love is one of those things. I don't think love can properly be reduced to an equation. My students have tried to figure it out. Because they want to know if this person loves them. I said, no, it's much more complicated. Anything else? Well, thank you very much for your kind attention. Just there. I was just like, oh boy, I'm going to bed now.
What wondrous love is this, oh my soul, oh my soul. What wondrous love is this, oh my soul? What wondrous love is this that caused the Lord of bliss to bear the dreadful curse for my soul, for my soul? To bear the dreadful curse for my soul. To God and to the Lamb I will sing, I will sing. To God and to the Lamb I will sing. To God and to the Lamb who is the great I Am. While millions join the theme, I will sing, I will sing. While millions join the theme, I will sing. I'll sing on, I'll sing on. And when from death I'm free, I'll sing on. And when from death I'm free, I'll sing and joyful be. And through eternity I'll sing.